You're listening to Midori Howe's first broadcast on the 14th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, has Islamic State used mustard gas against Kurdish soldiers? And if it has, does that change the campaign against IS? My guests Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall will discuss that and the day's other big stories, including renewed fighting in Kashmir as Pakistan's president uses his Independence Day speech to sort of wave an olive branch in India's general direction. The growing diplomatic row around the humanitarian crisis at Calais. The town's mayor threatens to open the border if Britain doesn't do more to help. And 70 years on from Japan's surrender, Shinzo Abe reaffirms remorse for his country's role in the Second World War. But how guilty should Japan still feel? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are the regular Monocle 24 contributors, Tim Marshall, veteran foreign correspondent and now of thewhatandthewhy.com, and London-based freelance journalist and writer and assistant editor of New Humanist, Samira Shackle. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the ongoing conflict against Islamic State, who are at least persistently inventive in their awfulness. In the last 24 hours, officials from the United States and Germany have suggested that IS deployed mustard gas against Kurdish Peshmerga troops amid fighting near Erbil earlier this month. IS have previously been accused of deploying chlorine. Tim, does this change anything? There's both a legal and a moral stigma around the use of gas on the battlefield. It has been used, almost certainly been used, by Assad's forces in Syria. Does this represent, if true at least, is this a thing to which the forces fighting Islamic State will be obliged to respond severely?
No. And I can expand on that if you want.
Please do.
No, because it's not the first time. It's the first time that the Germans and the US government have both come out and said, yeah, you know what, we're pretty sure it has happened and it's mustard gas. But they've used chlorine bombs, which is also chemical warfare, and they've used those in the past against the Kurds. I've got a piece that's going to run tomorrow written by a chap called Hamish de Breton Gordon. He used to be the commanding officer of NATO's anti-chemical warfare unit. You know, he knows his stuff. And he was telling me that they have used this stuff before. And his view on it, which I'll pass on, especially because I agree with it, is that they're using it as a weapon of terror, not as an actual sort of tactical weapon, because you're actually better off using different types of warfare. You'll kill more people. But what you do with gas is you scare the hell out of everybody. And he puts this into the pattern of behavior where you behead people and video it, where you then go to even more extremes and video it, and you use mustard gas. And he's correct, when Hamish de Breton Gordon, when he says they have been overwhelmingly successful at getting people to run away before they even attack them. And he puts it in that category.
Samira, what do you think? Because a similar thought struck me as well, that it is, aside from any use it may have as a battlefield weapon, it is in keeping with Islamic State's theatrical tendencies, them creating their desire to create a grand spectacle of some sort.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think it's that sort of comes down to the fundamental meaning of terrorism, which is to create terror. And it's a terrorist group through and through, in that they trade on creating fear, they trade on being ever more shocking. They've been able to displace Al-Qaeda as the sort of world's primary global jihadist movement, I'd argue, largely through this sort of seeking spectacle, seeking more extremity, seeking to create more and more terror. And that's something that they've actually done very, very effectively. I think also the idea of sort of chemical weapons, in addition to creating fear, which I'd absolutely agree with everything that's been said. I think in addition to that, it also, I think, says something about the organisation of the group using it, because these are quite, perhaps less so for chlorine bombs, which have been used before, but things like nerve agents, mustard gas and so on, those are actually really difficult to use, to deploy without sort of succumbing to their effects yourself. And therefore, they're quite unusual for unconventional armies like Islamic State, like ISIS, to use. And so I think it also might be saying something about their sort of strategic, their tactical ability, that they're apparently being able to deploy these weapons without succumbing to the effects themselves, which again feeds into creating terror and sort of what is it we're dealing with, this idea of it being an ever increasingly powerful force.
Tim, if as you suggest, the use of mustard gas, if indeed that's what's happened, is not, if you will, a tripwire which finally brings down the absolutely untrammeled wrath of their enemies upon them, what might be?
I think if they'd have carried out a campaign the way that Saddam Hussein did against the Kurds, when he killed thousands with the use of advanced chemical weapons.
This is Operation Anfal in 88.
Right. Yeah. That would change things. But on this particular occasion this week, about 60 Peshmerga Kurdish soldiers have become violently ill. I don't think there's been any fatalities from this attack. And so it's just not going to be the trigger. Who's going to ride to the rescue? The Iraqi army is not about to ride to the rescue of the Peshmerga, even though they're allied. They're only allied
temporarily. I'm not sure the Iraqi army could ride to the rescue of a cat stuck up a tree.
Voila. So, you know, exactly who's going to ride to the rescue? Who's going to do more than they're already doing? The Americans are pretty busy and, of course, are now about to increase their activity. Well, they've already started in Syria because they've got the Turkish Incirlik air base now. As I said, I put it into a different category of that it is about terror. It is about the brand. And I'm not underestimating how awful it is. But secondly, well, Julie Bishop, Australia's foreign minister,
yep.
She was the first one last month. She made a speech, which didn't get that much attention, but she made a speech last month saying, these guys are going to use it, and once they've used it, they're going to try and use it elsewhere. And there is the possibility that the people that are getting expertise in trying to put this together, because it's not easy, and then deploying it, which is even harder, those people one day might well be coming back to France, to Germany, to Britain. So there's an added problem there. I mean, we all know there's going to be some returnees and things will happen at some point. God forbid it happens with this manner of warfare.
Final thought on this from you, Samira, before we move on. We were talking there about, you know, Islamic State's use of spectacle, and you made the point that having created one spectacle, you are then obliged to create something even more extreme to carry on generating the attention and the terror you wish to generate. Do you get the sense, and it's obviously very hard to inhabit the minds of maniacs, that they even know themselves where they're going with this?
Yeah, it is. I do get that sense, actually. It's sort of, I think that in the most basic terms, the goal is gaining more and more territory and getting more and more recruits. But yeah, I think that sort of idea of where's it all going to end, what's the ultimate end game, is quite difficult to visualize, because on the one hand, they've put quite a lot of resources into making the territories they control sort of doing the things that a state does, but on the other hand, they obviously don't behave like a state. They behave like a guerrilla army, like a terrorist group, and so on. And it's quite difficult to see, sort of, at what point those two things come together. And it's also quite frightening, I think, for any observer of it to just see that this sort of constant seeking of more extremity, and it's quite frightening to think about where that will go.
Okay, well, let's move on from a conflict which has only seemed hopelessly intractable for a few years to one which has seemed hopelessly intractable for several decades. Pakistan and India have been trading fire in Kashmir today, leaving at least one person dead and forcing many to flee their homes. Almost literally as this was occurring, Pakistan's President Manmohan Hussein gave a televised speech commemorating Pakistan's Independence Day, in which he spoke of his wish for peaceful coexistence with India and for a resolution of the Kashmir issue. Samira, first of all, and we've probably got, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes before the break, let's see if we can sort this out. Is the Kashmir issue, is it in fact resolvable?
There's certainly no easy resolution to it. And I think the fact that it's been, you know, this time, the anniversary of partition, which happened in 1947, is tense every year. And I think will keep being tense every year. And I think in much the same manner as the Israel-Palestine conflict seems quite intractable and people have got more and more entrenched in their positions as time has passed, the same thing has happened with Kashmir. I think that, you know, that the solutions that are on the table, first of all, no one's really willing to discuss them, because so you don't have the basic starting point for a negotiation, which is that none of the parties are willing to sit around a negotiating table. And I think secondly, people have just got more and more entrenched in their positions. So you've got sort of India wants the line of control where there's been firing at the moment. India wants that line of control to become an international border. Pakistan doesn't want that. Pakistan wants to take Kashmir under its jurisdiction because it's a Muslim majority state. Some people in Kashmir want that. Some people don't want that, particularly the Hindus and Buddhists aren't particularly enamored with the idea of becoming part of Pakistan. You've also got independence movement since 1989 of people who want independence for Kashmir. The fact is that neither India nor Pakistan want to cede territory. There's also worries that if Kashmir was to get independent, it would lead to sort of balkanization because you do have other states within India and Pakistan calling for independence. And so it's really, really difficult to see a way out of it because none of the parties concerned, the sort of Kashmiri independence movement, the Pakistani government, the Indian government, none of them are offering a solution which is at all palatable to any of the others. And so even the idea of holding a referendum, for instance, which I think would probably go the way of independence, that's not something that India wants to allow, Pakistan wants to allow. I mean, yesterday in the Indian-controlled parts of Kashmir, there was a curfew just so, and sort of the minister for the state said that he didn't want any violence or to see people hoisting Pakistan flags to celebrate Independence Day. So, you know, it's a live issue now so many years later, and it's really difficult to see resolution and or even really any willingness to start negotiations in a serious way.
Tim, as is traditional, after today's exchange of fire, both sides have said it was all the other side's fault. You have covered in your previous role as diplomatic editor of Sky News any number of interminable, intractable conflicts. Do you get the sense about this one, because it's a sense I've got myself in a couple of similar places, I've not been to Kashmir, that they reach a point at which everybody on both sides is just still doing it because it's what they've always done. It doesn't occur to anybody to stop shooting at each other.
They're glaring at each other all the time and they're very tense, and then something happens and somebody twitches and off they go. I mean, you know, there has been firing today. It's one of the reasons it's got headlines is because it is Independence Day for Pakistan.
Indeed so.
But there's a second reason, and actually the second reason is more important. This is a situation that is not going to go away, and so you manage it. And how you manage it is very, very important. And they are managing it. And they're doing it through gesture politics, whilst at the same time occasionally firing at each other. And if you were to believe the Indians, the Pakistanis occasionally sanction a terrorist group to have a terrorist act in India. Pakistan, of course, denies that. But what I meant about the second thing is more important is how it's being managed. This week, it is, apart from the Pakistani woman that died in the shelling today, and her children and her husband were injured in the shelling. Apart from that, the most significant event that has happened this week is that the Pakistanis have agreed they will attend the meeting they were invited to in New Delhi on August the 23rd of their version of the National Security Secretaries of State. So at extremely high level, you know, just about at the top, they will come to India and they will talk. That's actually more meaningful and important than the shelling, because that tells you the direction they're trying to come. Not to an agreement about Kashmir, they're trying to come to an agreement where they just can just sort of manage their situation and their relationship.
On that subject, Samira, of managing Kashmir, and again, as I said, I don't know Kashmir particularly, but is it one of those conflicts as well? And I think it's certainly something that is the case in Israel and Palestine, where one of the impediments to a solution is that the leadership on both sides are actually possibly even more scared of their own people than they are of the opposition. They are scared of what might befall them if they're seen to offer any of the concessions that would be necessary to make peace, as you would not need to tell Anwar Sadat or Yitzhak Rabin, for example.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And I think definitely in the case of India and Pakistan, relations more generally, even beyond Kashmir, there's a sense of it's sort of squaring up to each other. It's not wanting to look like the weaker party, particularly in Pakistan. There's a lot of paranoia because India's just so much bigger, and there's this sort of big sense of this behemoth that could destroy us at any moment if they chose to. So I think that's definitely true. So just the sort of rhetoric that's been coming from the current Pakistani government, I think, is quite significant, as Tim was saying, because they're talking about repairing relations with India, they're talking about a better business relationship and so on. But I think that certainly is true. There's huge anxiety about public opinion on both sides. I mean, I've been in both India and Pakistan in the last year, and just the sort of way that people in both countries, the public at large, talk about the other, you'd think they were sort of talking about sort of devils. It's not like dehumanizing. It's very extraordinary.
I mean, I haven't set foot in either country for 15 years, but I remember hearing the same thing, and it is extraordinary, unreconstructed pre-First World War stuff.
Absolutely, and so I think that certainly leaders on both sides would not want to appear weak, I think, to their own publics as much as to other governments, and they're certainly playing to their own supporters, I think, with some of this trading of recriminations.
What do you think, Tim? Is it likely to be ever feasibly possible, at least in the next few years, that a Pakistani prime minister or an Indian prime minister is going to feel confident enough to say to their own people, we are going to have to throw the other lot a bone if we're going to get this sorted out?
Yes, but the bone isn't Kashmir. There are other bones that can be thrown each way. I agree with, unfortunately, what you said at the beginning and what has subsequently been said. I'm not sure it is solvable, certainly not in the foreseeable future. But they have both realised that they do need a relationship. The world does change. China does grow more powerful, etc., etc., etc. And they're feeling their way towards a better relationship at the moment. They've done it in the past and it's fallen apart. But, you know, like I said, gesture politics actually is important, because it creates the mood, and they are both involved in gesture politics, and they're moving towards better relations where at least they could try not to shell each other every now and again. But they're never going to love each other for the reasons that Samir's said.
On that happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, we will be looking at the ongoing crisis in Calais and the ongoing diplomatic wrangles about whether or not Japan is apologising enough for the events of seven decades past.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
What we're trying to do is to keep our tentacles spread far and wide, I suppose, for this vast, vast country and this really dynamic city too here in Toronto, to try and bring the most accurate and the most vibrant flavour we can of this place that we hold so dearly to us.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Anchored by Monocle's unrivaled team of editors and correspondents and produced out of our bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, AsiaPac Unwrapped is an unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region.
We're in prime position to set the agenda for the week ahead in what is, I don't think it's controversial to say, possibly the most dynamic sort of markets in the world.
I think also audio is really a unique place to be when we're telling this story.
AsiaPac Unwrapped is all about seizing opportunities, whether it's the best places to invest, the finest destinations for a well-deserved break, or inspiring stories from the region's smartest business people.
We really want this program to be something which absolutely follows our audience and not even just follows them, hopefully directs them all around the APAC region. So I think that's also just a very interesting relationship that suddenly that we can have, I think, you know, up and down Asia, north to south.
In partnership with ANZ, AsiaPac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 brings a world of exciting opportunities right to your doorstep. Tune in every Monday at 7 a.m. Sydney time, that's 2200 hours London time on Sundays, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. Now, let's look now at the UK, where one would not necessarily need to be a Daily Express reading UKIP voting pull up the drawbridge Little Englander to suspect a measure of cynicism about France's continued tactic of parking refugees as close as possible to the entrance to the Channel Tunnel. More than 3,000 are currently dwelling in a camp outside Calais. In recent weeks, hundreds every night have been attempting the crossing. At least 9 of them have died trying this summer. Now the mayor of Calais, Natasha Bouchart, has threatened to open the border if Britain does not do more to help. Samira, first of all, leaving aside any sympathy we may or indeed should feel for what these people have experienced, where they came from, and to get to where they are they not France's responsibility entirely if they're in France?
Well, legally, yes, I think, but I think it, yeah, I mean, that's the, there's a treaty that specifies that it is France's responsibility, which the mayor of Calais wants to have revoked. I think it's a slight grey area because the migrants at Calais are a self-selecting sample who want to get to the UK, and I think that's the argument that they're making. But I think it really does come back to this whole... this whole dispute, I think, really comes back to the much wider issue of, you know, we've got to remember this is a very small proportion of the migrants who are trying to reach the EU at large, and it's just a localised manifestation of the fact that we need a sort of sensible EU-wide policy about the resettlement of migrants. And I think, at the moment we're... the increased numbers of migrants are due to absolutely huge scale humanitarian crisis. We've got the biggest proportion of global refugees since World War II. But I mean, if we're looking specifically at Calais, and just to complete that point, sorry, I think that the that exceptional circumstance requires a different way of thinking about it. But this situation at Calais is not new. I mean, this has been going on for well over a decade, and it's France and Britain both focus on tough policing. France says, Britain, you need to do more. So Britain, as it has now, sort of gives more money for security or for fences. No one talks about really tackling the problem. The focus is on tough policing, and occasionally it blows up into a bigger crisis that sort of hits the headlines. And this has happened periodically over the last 15 years, and it's now particularly acute because of the huge-scale global refugee crisis that we're seeing.
Tim, Samira correctly points out that the 3,000-odd people at the camp in Calais are an infinitesimal percentage of refugees either in or trying to get into Europe. They're a tiny fraction of the numbers of people in this country on overstayed visas, for example. I suspect not a few of my own country folk among them. I'm entirely legal, just so we're clear on that.
Have you got anything to prove that?
No, I really don't. But is it just in this country that there seems to be a complete lack of capacity to have a sort of sensible, rational discussion of the issue? It seems to be driven to a huge extent by the agenda of a couple of newspapers in particular, and the terror of politicians of upsetting them.
Well, I don't know how many folk you talk to, but everyone I know is very exercised by this story, and it's got nothing to do with just the two particular newspapers. Everybody I know is exercised by this story. I've got some friends from Macedonia and Montenegro and Bosnia, and they're very exercised by it. They're saying, what the hell, are you guys crazy? Why are you letting all these people in?
We're not.
I know we're not. But the popular perception is, and as I said, I've got various friends from various...
I don't know where that perception would come from, though, since all we're doing is building more fences.
The people at Calais are not coming in, but thousands and thousands of people are coming in all the time, and a lot of people... It doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. I mean, I don't really usually get into the rights and wrongs. I try to stick with what it is. And I think it's actually hundreds of thousands. There's a city the size of Sheffield.
If we're including legal migration from the EU, absolutely, yeah.
Which is tied together, especially in the public perception. Let me rewind a wee bit. Again, some of the debate always says, and you talked earlier, and I think your position has been somewhat changed, about our little England UKIP voting, this, that, and other, saying you don't have to be one of those to be concerned. And that's how the conversation has slightly changed, because only the UKIP little England types who were sneered at for many, many years were the ones who did talk about it, and everybody else just put their head in the sand. Now, we've realised we do have a problem, but there's a new thing that's crept into the argument, and that is, why do we care about it? It's only 6,000, it doesn't matter, look at what's going on. Yeah, you do look at what's going on in Syria and the catastrophe in Libya and the terrible human tragedies of the people that are trying to come across. And, you know, in 50 years, we will look back at this the way we look back at the refugees trying to flee Europe in the 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. and think, why didn't people do more? I accept all that argument.
But it's no good being some sort of snobby Hampstead liberal. Sorry, for your foreign listener, for listeners abroad, that means you've got quite a lot of money, but you you drink champagne, but you're left of centre. It's no good your Hampstead liberal saying, this doesn't matter. You tell that to the thousands of lorry drivers who get stuck. You tell that to the thousands of small businesses that are losing money. You tell that to the tens of thousands of people in the south of England who's, I mean, yet their lives being disrupted is hardly akin to falling off a ship in the middle of the Mediterranean. But it is the epitome of snobbery and not understanding your own people to really think that it doesn't matter for these hundreds of thousands of people in Britain that are affected by this. It's like, you're really telling these people it doesn't matter?
Just
give me a break.
None of which I dispute. And on that, sort of following on from that, Samir, does it leave, I guess, the leadership of this country in a frankly impossible position? Yeah. Because it is politically extremely difficult, to say the least, for any prime minister of this country to say, well, okay, we'll take these people or we'll help them out.
Yeah, I think it's politically difficult, and I wouldn't dispute that. But I would argue that I think one of the issues is the fact that we do have this sort of public concern about migration, and I think that kind of gets really drummed up by the fact that people conflate, as Tim just did, with respect EU migration, which is fully legal, asylum seekers who are fleeing conflict, illegal migrants who are here seeking a better economic situation, and so on. And all that, if all those things get mentioned, you know, along with sort of perfectly legal migrants from all over the world who are coming here to work, when all of those things get conflated, as they do, that is not something that should be corroborated and reinforced by our politicians, which is what's happening. And I think that actually, you know, our government has staked a huge amount on reducing net migration to the tens of thousands, which is quite a ludicrous target, I would argue. But I think that also this is an exceptional circumstance. The numbers that we're talking in sort of legal resettlement programs wouldn't have that huge an impact on targets anyway. There is scope for the government to do more, given the fact that this is a really exceptional global circumstance. And I think that if that case was made positively, and actually more importantly, you know, Tim's talking about the disruptive impact on people in certain areas of the country, I wouldn't dispute that either. But I think that disruptive influence on their lives is hugely compounded by the fact that we don't have a sensible policy on this. So if people are coming in by illegal channels, then you're not regulating the flow of people, you're not keeping checks on where they are. So it's actually quite counterproductive policy making, apart from anything else. So give people legal channels by which to come, give them a temporary visa so you can keep track of them, and so you can control where in the country they're going to. And surely that makes sense, even if you sort of don't want them to be sneaking in here and being here forever.
I conflated it by the next sentence was because the public idea of it is all as one. Very briefly, I gave a talk at the London School of Economics last week, and the sentence that went down the best was, I said, I actually welcome immigration. I want more immigration. We're all aware of the population pyramid being inverted in Europe. And I said, when I'm older, I want someone to look after me, and I don't care where they came from as long as they change my bedpan.
Very, very finally tonight, we do need to look at a story from Germany where the excitable tabloid Bild has been doing its bit for Russo-German relations. It printed a photo of a bomb affixed to the undercarriage of a Russian combat aircraft emblazoned with a slogan, "To Berlin." They neglected to provide the helpful context that the phrase is a Russian military battle cry dating from 1945 or thereabouts. That or Tim, and we just have time for a final thought on this from each. Is this just a willful failure to understand the military sense of humour?
Absolutely. Military people always think it's very funny to write obscenities and unpleasant things about the enemy on their missiles. It's not something I would choose to do. Let me give you another headline that was also wrong this week. In the Times, they printed an article which included the words, "He is the first non-Catholic Pope in 500 years.
It was one of the more glorious newspaper corrections in recent history, the one that followed that. Just a very final brief thought on the Bild story, Samira. Are we being too paranoid about Russia? Is that what this has played into?
Well, I think I'd be worried if more serious newspapers took this story up and reported it in good faith, definitely.
The Russians are coming. It is Bild. God bless it. It contributes immensely to the gaiety of nations. We will need to leave it there. Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Apologies that we didn't get to talk in any depth whatsoever about Shinzo Abe's semi-apology, but we can possibly get to that another day. It's not a story that's going anywhere. That is all time for we have for today's episode. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello, and Eugenia Elenskaya. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, our Istanbul bureau chief, Chris Lord, will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows with a menu at 1900, and at 2200, it's the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. For this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.